Big Tony.
Good morning.
Tony, what's up, bro? How are you?
I'm good. You got an early morning today, didn't you?
I was going to say, can you hear the difference in my voice? Because I'm a morning person now.
Wow. Just like that.
Yeah, just like that. I'm a morning person. I went from a night person, someone who stays up late and just, you know, chills at late at night to, dude, I'm in bed by like 8:39. And I flipped this on a dime, just like out of nowhere, 8:39, in bed, up at 5:30. This just happened like a week and a half ago. And my wife laughs. She's like, this is like the most you thing ever. It's like, when you just randomly decide that that's what you're going to do, it's just like, I just do that. It's like the most cliche me thing. It's like, all right, like now I'm a morning person.
As simple as that, huh?
As simple as that.
So yeah. Take me to the first morning when your alarm clock goes off. At what time now?
So I brought it down. The first morning was at 6. Then it went to 5:45. Then it went to 5:30. And now it's at 5:20.
Okay. So you gave yourself sort of a few days to
Yeah. Adjust. It wasn't super gradual. It wasn't like 1 week at 6, then 1 week at 5:45. It was like literally like first day's at 6, next day's at 5:45, next day's at 5:30, next day's at 5:20. And that's where I am right now.
Was the first day harder than the fourth day?
I would say the fourth day was the hardest day. The first day, there was like, when I was almost anticipating it as soon as I woke up, like I was like, there was a little bit of adrenaline. And oh, dude,
you're
I know
excited.
What I was excited. I had told Instagram, I was like, this is what I'm going to do. So there was the expectation of me doing it. I didn't want to let people down. I didn't want to people be like, oh, I didn't want people to use it as a justification for them not doing it. And as soon as I got up, people were like, oh man, I was waiting for this. I'm lying in bed now. Now I've got to get up, which was cool to see that people wanted to do it because I had done it. So the first day I was like ready to go. I'd say like by 4 or 5 days in, I was like, nah, like not feeling so hot, but I was up. And like, I have this thing in my head where as soon as I wake up, I think, eyes open, feet hit the floor. It's like I have to immediately put my feet on the floor because if I wait even 4 seconds, I can convince myself, no, I'll just wait a little bit. It's like eyes open, feet hit the floor. That's the first thought that goes through my head. It's just, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I have noticed the times that I snooze versus the times that I just get up. I tend to feel better if I just get up, even if I don't want to.
Yeah.
There's something about waking up and then falling back into that half sleep that just leaves me feeling groggy.
Dude, I was listening to a podcast about this within the last few weeks before I decided to make this change. And it was basically, it was a sleep expert. And I forget her name, but she was talking about how when you go back to sleep, like you end up oftentimes, you then end up waking up in the middle of a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you feel way worse than if you had just gotten up earlier. I have also been putting my phone across the room so that when the alarm goes off, it's like, oh, like I can't just let that thing blare for five minutes. Like I've got to get up. So it helps with the eyes open, feet hit the floor. I know it's like such a cliche recommendation too of like, put your phone across the room, but like it actually fucking works because you got to get up. And then I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm going to get back into bed now.
Yeah.
That's just like the most, like start off the day with a huge failure.
So were you really tired at the end of the day after this?
Yeah, I've been getting very tired now. By like 8:30, I'm telling my wife, I'm like, I've got to go to bed. And she has this whole nighttime routine. I don't even know what it, I don't know how it works. There's creams and there's water and there's lotions and I don't know. And there's things that go on the face. I don't know. I don't get it, but it takes a while. And, you know, the doors open to the bedroom and the lights coming in and I'm like, I'm trying to go to sleep. And she's like, I've got to do my bedtime routine. And so, yeah, that's I'm pretty exhausted. So I'm in bed by like 8:30, 8:45, and then she'll sidle in around 9:15 and then I'm out fast.
Have you considered a sleep mask?
You know what, for me, it's funny. It's not even about the light. It's like there's a comfort of like when I'm in bed alone versus when she's in bed. It's like there's the warmth, and we don't even cuddle. Not my choice. I'm a cuddler. She's not. She needs space.
Stone cold.
Dude, she's got these like mountains of pillows. She's got Mount Kilimanjaro of pillows over here. She's got like 14 pillows under her head, and she's got like a wall up, and I'll try and cuddle, and she's like, I get so hot. I just get so hot. I need my space. I'm like, but there's just like, I can tell when she's in bed versus when she's not. And that's like a big thing for me.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty close though. Like 8:30 to 9:15. Like you guys are pretty synced up.
Yeah.
I have, you know, when I'm working late at night, you know, I'll get home sometimes around 3 and I need like an hour or so to wind down, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, we'll be on totally different schedules for parts of the week. So
that's so interesting. I was talking to my buddy, Josh Smith. He's a psychologist. I've had him on the podcast once before, and him and I were on the phone within the last month or so talking about what you just said. Are you more of an introvert?
So yes and no. I know that's
okay.
But
it's okay.
But
there's a spectrum. It's not just one or the other.
I think I'm like a manic introvert, you know. It's like I love going out and being around people and like seeing my friends and doing that, and then I want to be at home by myself, not talking to anyone for days afterwards. Like it's both.
Yeah, I get it. He was telling me that he's transitioned throughout his life, where he used to be a huge extrovert, just always wanted to be around people. And like after a full day of work, he would ask his colleagues, hey, like, let's go out and get something to eat and drink. Like he just always wanted to be around people. But now that, you know, he has a wife and he has 2 kids, like ever since that's happened, he's become more introverted. He's wanted to be more like not out with other people, more just at home, either with himself or with his family. And he was saying that it was a difficult transition because when he was more extroverted, when he would come home, he didn't like being alone. So he would just want to go to bed. Like he didn't want to just like stay up alone. Like he would just want to go to bed, versus now when he comes home from a situation, like he needs some time just to himself. Mm-hmm. Like he doesn't want to go to bed yet because he wants to just like have some alone time with him, which is interesting to see how that works. So when you said, yeah, like when you get home, like you need to have an hour, decompress, just be with yourself. I was interested in that.
Yeah. And I found a short circuit for that, like having a beer after work makes it okay to just like transition into people again.
Yeah.
Which, you know, maybe isn't the healthiest hack. Listeners at home, I'm not saying try this. But yeah, I've noticed that like it just takes the edge off in that situation, like, socially, you know.
This is the best for on like a health podcast. We're like, I found a shortcut. It's alcohol, which actually is a good segue into the things we'll be talking about in today's podcast, which some of which is alcohol.
Yeah. I hear you got some listener questions about alcohol.
Yes. So I've got some questions about alcohol. Figured we'd go through. So I've got 2 questions, and one of them I actually posted on my story, but we can go into more depth on it here. And the other one I didn't post on my story. The first one, someone asked, what is the lesser of 2 evils, sugar or alcohol? And I wrote, neither are evil, for all of the reasons anyone who's ever listened to my podcast knows. I said, but alcohol is a legitimate toxin. It's not good for you. I said, I love having drinks every week with my wife and friends, but I'm not going to pretend it's a healthy drink, even though you can incorporate it into a healthy lifestyle, which is an important distinction to make between something that's like healthy, has health benefits for you, and something that you can still incorporate into a healthy lifestyle. Alcohol is one of those things that I don't care what someone, like there's no health benefits to it. Like it's not, but you can still have it as part of a healthy lifestyle.
So what about like those studies that are like, actually a glass of wine is good for your heart, or like,
yeah, so
actually,
usually they're looking at things in isolation. They're looking at one aspect. They're looking at like, alcohol has antioxidants, or red wine, for example, has mm-hmm. antioxidants. So it's good for your heart. It's a very reductionist way to look at things. I'm struggling to come up with a good analogy for it, but your body is impacted by more than just the antioxidants, right? So just because there is antioxidants in it doesn't mean that it's net good for you. There, I would say, like, if we're looking at the net, like there might be little things in it that could potentially have a positive effect. But if we're looking at the net total effect at the end of everything that's included in it, which, by the way, ethanol, people talk about toxins, right? Like actual eating toxins, like ethanol is a legitimate toxin. It is not good for you. We know that over a long period of time, it has a much higher risk of causing cancer, much higher risk of heart disease, metabolic, like so many issues. So yeah, there are antioxidants in red wine, but that doesn't make it good for your heart overall. I would say net, it's actually way worse for your heart. Now, the thing that I find interesting is that if we look at people who live very, very long lives, like centenarians, people who live 100 plus, many of them drink alcohol. Many of them drink alcohol. It's not a lot, usually. They're usually not pounding down a bottle of wine a night. But regularly, they'll have a glass of wine or maybe two glasses of wine, which for me is, that's the perfect example of it might not be good for you, but you can still incorporate it into a healthy life. And again, assuming you're not an alcoholic or something, someone that struggles from an addiction perspective. But I also think another aspect of centenarians and people who live super, super, super long lives is the genetic component. And I think this is something that goes massively overlooked. In every aspect of life, we understand genetics is important. I'm never going to be an NBA basketball player. No matter how hard I fucking try, I'm just not going to, it's not going to happen for many reasons.
Muggsy Bogues was just holding the flag for all of us, man.
Exactly, dude. For all the short guys, he was the one, and he was amazing. But the outlier isn't the rule. And so genetics play a role in everything, not least of which is absolutely living a very, 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 very long life can play a role in how long you live. But it goes to show that you can include alcohol, but it's not a health drink, if that makes sense. I would say a health drink would be water. Like, water has a net positive effect. And to be fair, if you go to the extreme, too much water can kill you. You drink too much water. Yeah.
I just read another headline where someone was dehydrated on a hike and they ended up drinking something like 64 ounces of water in 20 minutes.
Shit.
And that was it.
Diluted their blood too much. Yeah. That's what happened.
Electrolytic shock, I think, is what.
Yep. Yeah, because they had already sweat out so much. Alex Viotto, who I've had on this podcast a number of times talking about Zone 2, has an amazing story about this with himself, where he was on a super long run and he found himself in a super hot area. I forget, it might have been Arizona or somewhere in California, but he was on a really long run and he could tell he was getting dehydrated. He had to stop himself because he didn't have electrolytes. He only had water, and he had to literally like stop himself from drinking because he knew it could be dangerous, like what just happened with the person you're talking about. So what he actually had to do was, and I'm not recommending this to anyone, this is a very extreme situation. This is not like if you're going on the elliptical or treadmill for a fucking hour. This is like hours and hours and hours and hours into a really long activity, a lot of sweating and not enough electrolytes. He like had his shirt wrapped around him, so when he sweat, the salt would come out and into the shirt. And he literally was like trying to suck out the salt from the shirt so that he could stay, like it replenished the electrolytes, which also made him a little bit more thirsty. But he was like, if he drank too much, he knew it could cause some issues with electrolyte imbalances. So yeah, like anything too in excess is bad. So too much water can literally kill you. So when I'm talking about alcohol, I enjoy it on occasion, and I enjoy it, I'd say even more than on occasion. I enjoy it relatively frequently, but even though I enjoy it, I'm not going to play these mental gymnastics and try and say, yeah, it's really good for you. It's not, but you can still incorporate it into a healthy lifestyle, which is an important distinction to make. I said sugar, going back to the question, sugar is not a toxin. There are many ways to eat it in a healthy way. Alcohol is definitely the more dangerous one here for many reasons. So if we're answering this question, which one's the lesser of the two evils? Neither are evil, but alcohol is definitely the more dangerous one and the far less healthy one, that is for sure. The other question I got about alcohol was, she asked, does alcohol derail your progress or is it okay if you're still within a calorie deficit? And this is a really good question because I get a lot of people asking, can you still lose fat while drinking alcohol? So this person is obviously asking progress. She's referring to weight loss and fat loss specifically because she brought up calorie deficit. There are so many other aspects. Like she didn't say, can you still build muscle? She didn't say, like, can you improve your VO2 max? It was calorie deficit, which implies she's asking about fat loss. Mm-hmm. You can absolutely still lose fat while drinking alcohol as long as you're in a calorie deficit. There, people confuse. They hear that alcohol stops the fat burning process. And they think that that means that you are not losing fat. But there's a significant distinction between burning fat for fuel and losing body fat from your body. And I understand it can be confusing, but burning fat is essentially like substrate utilization is the fancy name for it. But your body will be burning different forms of energy in order to provide it energy, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you have alcohol, your body will turn to that to burn first and it will stop burning fat. But that doesn't mean that you won't lose fat from your body if you are in a calorie deficit. It's two different things. It's just, where's the energy coming from? So as long as you're in a calorie deficit, regardless of alcohol, yeah, you will absolutely lose weight. And I guarantee you, anyone who's listening who works in the ER, for example, my buddy Tucker, I've known Tucker since I was two. He was probably like my first friend. We did gymnastics together when we were two. He lives in Atlanta. I was just in Atlanta and he works in the ER now. He's an ER doctor. And he was actually talking to me about alcoholics and people who will come in and how they have to, if you have someone who's a severe alcoholic, oftentimes they can't just stop cold turkey. Like they need to wean them off or else they're going to have like real, real problems.
Yeah.
And he'll talk about how you get people coming in who are alcoholics who are very lean, like not, if alcohol prevented you from losing fat, then alcoholics would all be overweight just by nature, but that's not true. And again, I'm not promoting alcoholism. I don't think it's a smart idea, but it just goes to show that alcohol will not prevent you from losing body fat as long as you're in a calorie deficit. And so practically speaking, if that comes out to a couple or a few drinks per week, that's not going to derail your progress. I don't want you to worry. If you want to have a margarita or a Michelada or whatever it is, it's fine. You can have a couple of those a week and it's totally fine as long as you're in a calorie deficit. With that being said, I do think it makes it more difficult. For example, yesterday I had a beer with my lunch. Mm. I had a beer at 3 p.m., a little late lunch. And that meant that I wasn't able to eat as much at night because I had about a 150 calorie beer. So those calories were taken away. So it'll make it more difficult. Not to mention, have you ever played beer pong?
Yeah.
Great game. I love that game. And
are you good at it?
Not to brag, but I think I'm really good. Yeah, I'm very good. have you ever noticed that when you're playing beer pong, you can just keep playing and keep drinking and you don't really get overly full? Like, yeah, you might feel a little bit bloated, but you can just keep drinking. Have you ever noticed that?
So in my defense, I have usually most recently played where it's water in the cups.
Mm,
and the rule is you have to sip whatever you're drinking.
Okay. Yeah, but you're still drinking.
Instead of knocking back the cup of beer.
Yeah, yeah. But you're still drinking, and I would imagine a considerable amount, depending on how good or bad you are. Whereas if you actually, so there's a study around this. There was a study done where they had alcohol in the cups, and they had water in the cups. And when they were doing it with water as opposed to alcohol, this was with college students, they couldn't drink. They couldn't drink anymore. It took a much shorter period of time because they got full from drinking so much water. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the alcohol, you lose sensation. And so the sensation of hunger or fullness is diminished. And so you can keep drinking and keep drinking and keep drinking. And so oftentimes that's where people will screw up with alcohol, where they drink a bunch. And anyone who's been drunk knows, like, it's much easier to reach for the snacks. It's easy to keep drinking, drinking, drinking. It's also easy to just eat stuff that you wouldn't normally eat. Your inhibitions are down. You're like, ah, fuck it, whatever. I'm going to have this. I'm going to have that. It's usually not the alcohol causing the problems. It's usually the shit that you eat once you're already drunk. And you're like, ah, you're stumbling around the kitchen and you're having Cinnamon Toast Crunch and then ice cream. And that's usually where people run into issues with alcohol from a fat loss perspective.
Yeah, totally. I thought you were going in a different direction with that. Okay. So I'm just going to ask you about it. So I remember, and a couple of my friends have said this as well, like when we were in college and we would like go out and we'd be walking around everywhere and go to clubs and whatever we did, right? Mm-hmm. We were moving a ton and we felt like the hangovers weren't as bad. And I know that it's like there's a youth component here.
Yeah, that's true.
But on the times where I am like out and about and active or like doing lawn sports or whatever it is versus the times where I'm just sitting and have consumed alcohol, I feel like the former tends to be a better morning. And I was curious if you think that's there's like a like are we metabolizing the alcohol faster or like what's going on, do you think?
It's a great question. I absolutely very much think that we know very, even like right now, for example, I'm wearing a continuous glucose monitor, right?
Oh, yeah.
And this is for a 30-day challenge that I'm doing. And it's like, I've known this, but it's very cool to see that when I go on a walk after I eat, that dramatically improves my blood glucose versus if I don't go on. And I don't mean a brisk walk. I don't mean like I'm sweating. I don't mean a zone two. I mean a fucking stroll. Mm-hmm. If I go on a stroll after I eat, my blood sugar response is significantly improved compared to if I don't. And I would that it's just a, another example of how we metabolize things versus if we're moving versus if we're not. There's not a doubt in my mind that walking, especially on college campuses, you're walking a long distance some nights, that you're metabolizing it significantly better. And then it can, and also you're sweating out. And like, I think you're improving the metabolic process. And so it's with, for lack of a better term, flushing it out a little bit better, as opposed to just sitting down and doing nothing. There's not a doubt in my mind. And then not to mention, oftentimes, I remember like walking long distances, I would probably also drink more water. I would drink stuff as well in order, like, because I was walking a lot and I would get thirsty, and that could also just helping you stay hydrated could also help prevent the hangover as well. So all of these things combined, I think, and then obviously the youth on top of it for sure.
Oh, the youth.
The youth, man. The Utes. Do you know that movie? The Utes. Mm. Let's see it. You ever see My Cousin Vinny?
No.
Oh my God.
What am
God.
I missing?
Bro, this movie, I had this movie on VHS when I was a kid. This man, it was so good. I forget the name of the main actor. My Cousin Vinny, such a good movie. Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci played this guy named Vinny Gambini. Ralph Macchio was his nephew. He was basically I don't want to give it away. Just watch it.
Okay.
It's a hilarious, hilarious classic movie. Ralph Macchio is the guy who starred in Karate Kid.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's him. He's older. He's older in the movie. He's not super old because
he's not Cobra Kai old, but
he's not Cobra Kai old. And I haven't seen that. I don't want to ruin. I've heard actually good things, but I don't want to. The Karate Kid was one of those movies that I would watch over and over and over and over as a kid. And I don't want to ruin it like when they're bringing it back. So did you watch Cobra Kai?
I did. But
was it good?
I really enjoyed what I watched.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
I thought it was like really self-aware and funny and light. It was just cool to see like the same characters, like literally the same actors. You know, so many years later, I thought it was fun.
Okay. Okay. It's a series, right? It's not like one show. It's like a series of shows.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I haven't seen all of it, but there's many seasons out. And at this point, I think there's like four or five even.
That's one of the things I love about how cinema has evolved, where with movies, sometimes I wish there could have been more time for character development.
Oh, yeah.
I wish there could have been just more time. And I bet that any director, given their choice, the movie would have lasted another 3, 4, 5 hours, but they had to cut it down for whatever purpose. More recent cinema has evolved into shows and series, allowing for much longer character development, much more storytelling. That's one of my favorite things that's happened in recent years with movies and TV shows.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% there with you. And when you go back and watch something that you remember being like, oh, this was so fleshed out and deep, and it's in that like tight 90-minute format.
Yes.
And you're like, wait a second, what? It's like, boom, pop, 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 pop. And then it's over. And you're like, wait a second, like,
there's so much missing. Yeah.
But it's because we've gotten used to the long form.
Yes. Yes, exactly. I've heard they're going to do this with Harry Potter. They're going to make like a TV series. So instead of the movies, which, are you a Harry Potter guy?
I enjoy it. Yeah.
Did you ever read the books?
I read 5 of the books. No.
How do you stop at 5, bro?
I know. This is really embarrassing.
I can understand getting a little bit through the first book, but once you finish the first book, I don't know how you don't make it through all 7.
So they were all really good. I really liked them. I think it was a time in my life when they came out where it just like wasn't a top priority. And like, I wasn't one of those people that went to the bookstore at midnight and was like, you know, chatting about it the very next day. And like,
I was.
Yeah, no, and that's cool. I get it. It was a cultural phenomenon. And
yeah,
I don't know. I also think maybe I was trying to be subconsciously trying to be, you know, counterculture or contrarian or something.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was just like, everybody's all about this. Like, I'm good right now. I can wait.
We got to get you to read those other books. You're missing out, bro.
Yeah. No, it's a huge point of contention in my relationship. Like, potential deal breaker. So I got to do it.
Okay. Well, I'm on her side, just so you know.
you and the rest of the internet, we're going to find out.
There is a pretty strong anti-Harry Potter crowd. There's a strong number of people who are just like, no, I'll never do it. But like,
I haven't met those people.
Lucky you.
I've met like anti-author people, but that's a whole.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole separate discussion. Yeah. Yeah.
So I have a question about your glucose monitor.
Okay.
Can we get into it? Or are you saving it for the?
We can get into it, because I mean, the way I'm going with publishing these podcasts, there's a real chance this isn't coming out until that thing is ready. Anyway,
you know, it's a good point. So you were saying you get a blood glucose spike after you eat, generally.
So here's what's interesting. So you can get a blood glucose spike after you eat, yes, but that's not the only time you'll get a blood glucose spike. Blood glucose, so basically your cells, their preferred form of energy is blood glucose. What are you laughing at? What's that smirk for?
Oh, I was still thinking about Harry Potter, sorry. I swear I'm paying attention.
So I'll give you an example. I was doing jiu-jitsu the other day after I put the glucose monitor on, and for the first like 30 minutes of jiu-jitsu, it was just very low intensity drilling, nothing crazy. The last 30 minutes we started to roll live, and it got very, very intense. And then I looked at my CGM data, which is tracking all the time, and I saw a huge spike in my blood glucose. But I was fasted. I don't eat before jiu-jitsu, and I do jiu-jitsu early in the morning. So I was fasted from the night before. I was like 12 to 14 hours fasted at that point.
So I think I know what this is.
Okay, go for it. Of course, yes, absolutely.
Is this your body starting to metabolize fat because you ran out of blood sugar?
No. It's a great guess. So this is what's known as gluconeogenesis, which is it's a fancy term. It's basically your liver is creating blood glucose. It's creating glucose and it's releasing it into your bloodstream because your body needs energy. And so that's what was happening. So my liver released it into my bloodstream so that my cells could uptake it. And then I have more energy, which is amazing. And what's interesting to me is at a lower intensity, that's not happening. At a lower intensity, my blood glucose is dropping. But at a higher intensity, when I need more energy, like more quick energy, my liver will release that. Mm-hmm. There's also other factors as well. So as adrenaline goes up, as cortisol goes up, this can cause the liver to release blood glucose, which will then cause the pancreas to release insulin. And insulin will then shut. The insulin is essentially the key to open up the door of the cell, right? So insulin will transport the blood glucose to the cell, open up the cell, and then allow the blood glucose to go in to provide energy. And this is where we can get into insulin resistance, and we can get into diabetes type 1 or type 2, where if you have too much circulating insulin, or if or not enough insulin at all, then that can cause some serious issues. But to go back to your original question, eating causes a rise in blood glucose. Yes, it can and does, but it's not the only thing. There are many other things that can cause blood glucose to rise as well. There's another one I noticed around like midnight, 12:30, two nights ago. It didn't happen last night, but two nights ago, I had a dramatic rise in blood glucose. And I hadn't eaten since like 8 p.m. And usually you'll see a rise within like 30 to 60 minutes of eating, maybe even 15 minutes, depending on what you had. And I'm using this app. I'll say the name. I want to be very clear. I'm paying for this app. This is not sponsored. No one knows. It's like $300 a month, by the way. And fortunately, it's a tax write-off because I'm doing this for business purposes. And once this experiment is over, I'm going to stop doing it. But the first month that you start, you get a nutritionist. And so I was writing to her and I was like, hey, do you want to tell me like what you think could be going on? And she was like, oh, that's actually a really good question. There's something called the dawn phenomenon. Basically, where as you go through the night and as the morning hours begin to get closer, your body will release cortisol and sometimes other hormones, but essentially to help wake you up. And that's actually why cortisol is higher in the morning. It's one of the reasons why it's better to not check your blood pressure in the morning, because blood pressure is often higher due to that rise in cortisol. But cortisol will rise. And then as that is released, blood glucose will be released in response to that. And for many reasons, but as this stress hormone rises, your body's like, shit, I need energy. So then it will release blood glucose. So there are so many things that can spike your blood sugar, which to me is just hilarious, because so many people are out there saying like, don't eat fruit because it has sugar and sugar raises your blood sugar. And blood glucose and blood sugar, use them interchangeably, basically same thing, right? So it's so hilarious to me that people will say like, don't eat this, don't eat that because it raises your blood sugar. Meanwhile, it's like, they're also the ones advocating for high intensity interval training. It's like, you also know that raises your blood sugar too, right? It's just funny because it's not just what you eat that has an impact on it. And people are massively oversimplifying it.
Yeah. Yeah. These things are way more complicated than just one variable.
Yes.
But that is interesting that you said that the walking after a meal would mitigate that spike.
Yes.
And I'm just curious, like, I have no idea what the numbers mean, but I'd be curious, like, what would a normal look like? What would a spike, quote unquote, look like? And then what would a reduced spike look like in terms of numbers, just to get a sense?
So it really depends. And it's interesting. I've been posting my numbers on social media here and there. And it's been very interesting, because I get a lot of type 1 and type 2 diabetics, but especially a lot of type 1 diabetics reaching out and talking to me about my numbers and their numbers. And I got a great message last night from a woman who's a type 1 diabetic. And she was like, oh man, like your numbers are so good. I wish I had those numbers. And she asked, like, she said, would you mind just relaying to people that your numbers are really good? And what you see in a type 1 diabetic, like you might see go up to like 200 milligrams per deciliter. Whereas generally speaking, somewhere between like 75 to 120 to 120 is really good. 75 to 140 milligrams per deciliter is a good range to be within. But she was saying that she could have hers go up to like 200 or 300 milligrams per deciliter, which is a big fucking problem. And that's where, and to me, it's just, like I can show you my graph right now. No one's going to see this, but you can see there's like a green highlighted area.
Yeah.
And you see the graph. Mine is all in the green, right? Because thank God I'm healthy and I don't have a health issue with my blood sugar. Whereas what you might see with someone who's a diabetic is you might see a huge spike up, a mass, like well beyond. And the top of this, it goes up to 150. And that's like, theirs would be off the charts.
This graph is... he's hovering around 95, and then there's a spike that takes him up to 120 or so on that graph.
Yeah, correct. Exactly. Or go up to like 200 or 220, 250, 300. And that's where you can get into really, really serious health issues as a result of it. So, yeah.
So do you think that like this focus on blood sugar spikes is sort of a trickle down from talking about diabetes and then extrapolating like, oh, these spikes are bad, so now I'm going to look at the whole populace and say, oh, these spikes are bad, and transfer?
I don't think it's from a trickle down from diabetes. I think it's a misunderstanding of what it is, what it means. For example, we can even look at like a fasted cardio. Fasted cardio is a good example. People will say, oh, fasted cardio must be better. And I'll say, why? And like, well, because you don't have any food, so you're not burning the food. You're just burning straight fat. And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, substrate utilization. When you haven't had food yet, yes, you're going to be burning fat for fuel. But just because you're burning fat for fuel doesn't mean you're actually losing body fat. The only way to lose body fat is to not give your body enough energy to eat in a calorie deficit. So you could do fasted cardio, but if you eat too much on the back end, you're still going to gain fat, right? Mm-hmm. So people will look at things in a very reductionist, isolated way and just be like, okay, oh, I see this blood sugar spike. That must be bad. Well, why is that bad? What is that telling you overall? I don't think it's necessarily a trickle down from diabetes. I could be wrong. I think it's just more a misunderstanding of what they're actually looking at and what it means. And they're also looking at words like, right now, people look at the word sugar and they see evil. Mm-hmm. People actually think that sugar is evil. And it's literally, someone said in a question earlier in this podcast, what's the lesser of two evils? People actually believe sugar is evil. And yesterday when I did the Skittles for breakfast, I had people being like, you're destroying your heart, da 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 da. Because I said, by the way, I got a comprehensive blood panel done before this started, just so I can look at, I want to look at my health markers.
Yeah.
And this one woman was really upset, and it's not surprising. Like, she does keto and she's really attached to that lifestyle, and she's really invested in it. I think she's worried that it's going to prove her wrong, which could be with nutrition. So interesting, because people really associate their identity with their food choices. Like, so if I essentially go out and say, well, actually you can have sugar and it's not inherently bad for you in moderation, then her entire worldview has just collapsed in on her. So she got really upset and was like, you're going to be killing people and killing yourself. This is wrong. And I was like, yeah, but I got a really comprehensive blood panel done. This is going to show what's happened to my health over these 30 days. Was it actually something that hurt my health or not? Because one of my biggest regrets from the Big Mac challenge was I didn't do blood work. I lost 7 pounds in 30 days. And I showed people that you can have one Big Mac a day and still lose weight. But I really wish that I had done blood work and showed people what happened to my cholesterol, what happened to basically to everything, what happened to my blood work throughout that time. So this time I wanted to make sure I got an A1C. I wanted to make sure I got I got a very comprehensive blood panel done. I spent over $1,000 on this blood panel. And wow. It's funny, because I had my annual physical yesterday. And I brought in the blood panel and I was like, hey, just so you know, like, I got this done. And my doctor looked at it and she was like, oh my God, this is an unbelievably comprehensive blood panel. And she was actually really excited, because thank God it looked really good. But at the end of 30 days, I'm going to take another one just to see, because it's not just about weight loss. It's also about health. And I want to be aware of, let's say at the end of 30 days, my health is hurt. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that. And I want to explore that. I want to look at, like, was my A1C negatively affected as a result of having these big glucose spikes every single day? You know, so I don't know. I don't have all the answers. I just want to figure it out and learn just like everybody else.
Yeah, that's so cool, because it does feel like a black box to me, at least. You know, I recently got a blood panel done for my physical, and I was just scrolling through the results and like kind of Googling, these are the normal ranges, like this is what this means, this is what that means. And like what you want, what you're looking for, what I was looking for when I do that is like is this good or bad?
Right. Yes.
Like, that's exactly what I want to know. Like,
am I going to die?
Yeah. Exactly. And so it's really cool that you're providing this kind of information and context. Cause I, for one, find that extremely valuable.
Good, man. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So another question that's, I think, blood sugar related and alcohol related. Are you aware of a trend where like CrossFit people or like long distance runners or whatever would have a beer right after a long session?
They would have a beer?
Yeah. And the idea was like, oh yeah, just like get a bunch of energy in the system right away. And this was a thing, like people would have like beer at the finish line or beer at the end of the, like a beer, not like more than that. You hadn't heard of this. You're looking at me like I'm crazy.
No, I've never heard of that.
So I don't know how prevalent it is, but I have heard of this. And I'm curious what your take is on that.
What's my take on people drinking beer right after working out?
Yeah.
I mean, I've done that, but just because maybe I was going to meet my friends and I were like, hey, we're going to meet at this time. I was like, oh, all right, well, I got to get my workout in first because like I know after I drink, I'm not going to want to get my workout in. And then I just go and have a beer. But it's not because I'm like trying to, it's not like I'm trying to optimize my lift mm-hmm. by having alcohol. That quite frankly sounds idiotic to me.
Yeah.
There's nothing optimal about that whatsoever, like not in the least. So I have no clue where that came from. I have no idea why. It sounds fun, but like it's definitely not optimal from like a lifting, muscle growth, muscle recovery, strength, performance, any of that perspective at all.
Mm-hmm. So I have a personal question.
Okay, go for it.
So, you know, my knee is healing. And so okay. I've been getting under the pull-up bar. And I got one of those doorway pull-up bars that has the neutral grip,
yeah.
wide grip, the regular grip. And what's nice is it bends like up in a U instead okay. of just going straight. So I can actually like hang my legs down,
yeah.
which is something I haven't been able to do with a home pull-up bar before. So that's been really great. The limitation that I have is that I can't like jump up to do negatives.
Okay.
Which is something that I would normally incorporate.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, I've kind of got free reign. So I'm curious if I were to set like a short-term goal for like while my knee is healing to improve my pull-ups, like what would be a potential protocol that you might recommend?
I would recommend a grease the groove method. Have I spoken to you about that before?
I've heard of it. I've heard of it for sure.
So it's popularized by Pavel Tsatsouline. He's one of the first guys. Yeah. He's one of the first guys I started following when I was 14 because I started working at a kettlebell gym when I was 14 and he's the kettlebell guy.
Comrade.
It's actually genius marketing. If you look back on it, it's just like I think it was John Duquesne. And I could be wrong. I think John Duquesne was the one who found Pavel and really helped popularize him. But basically taking this Russian dude to really popularize Russian kettlebells in the United States, you take someone foreign and who's super strong and you really lean into the foreign aspect of it. Hello, comrade. Welcome to the Russian kettlebell certification. It's like, which is what he did. And they charged insane amounts of money for it. I think it was like $3,500 for a weekend certification for the RKC.
Wow.
But basically, grease the groove, and I think I've spoken about it on the podcast before, is just where you set up, for example, with chin-ups, if you have the chin-up bar, what room is it in? Like, what doorway?
So this is the unfortunate aspect of this, is it's the only, like, door frame that it fits and works in is the bedroom door frame.
Perfect. That's the great one.
Yeah, it's just, you know, like, sometimes someone wants to take a nap, and I'm, like, right in the zone where I want to be doing that, so you know it, I don't have full access to it all.
Someone or your girlfriend?
Someone.
Someone in the house wants to take a nap, and I'm in the zone.
I'm not gonna say any names here. All right.
Well, the cool thing about grease the groove is it's not like you need a whole workout to do it. It's just you do it sporadically throughout the day, and
sure.
the major purpose of it is, or the major component characteristic of it, is that you never go to failure, like not even close. I'm looking behind you. You've got stairs behind you. Mm-hmm. This is the easiest way to think about it. When you go up these stairs, like assuming you're not just devastated from workout, I'm assuming you're not anywhere near failure by the time you get up to the stairs, right? Like,
yeah, no,
at all. You could do that for a long time. But if you think
about it, I may not
it,
be the most fit, but I can get up those stairs.
You can get up those stairs, right? Well, if you think about it, every single stair that you go up is a step up, which is a legitimate exercise, right? Every time you're doing an exercise. And it's funny because no one would say you should only climb stairs one or two days a week. right? It's like, no, you climb stairs as part of your daily life. And so the concept of the grease the groove is you make whatever it is you're doing part of your daily life. So, and there's obviously a limit to this. You couldn't do this with, for example, a max effort deadlift every day. Number one, because you're going to failure. Number two is just because it's super physiological loads. It's super, 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 super heavy. But with something like body weight, you can absolutely do this on a daily basis. And so just like going up the stairs, you're not climbing up the stairs all day, but occasionally you'll go up and down the stairs. Occasionally, as you go through the bedroom, you pull yourself up. And maybe you just start off the first week just doing one rep every time you go in your door.
Mm-hmm.
Just one rep. That's it. And you shouldn't be tired. You shouldn't be shaking. It shouldn't be a difficult rep. It should just be a rep. And then the next week, maybe you do two reps. And then maybe you do that for the remainder of the month, two reps every time you go in that door. And then the next month, you start doing three reps every time you go in the door. And the progression, the speed of the progression can change based on you and your starting point and all of that. But essentially, you get to a point in which like you could do 5, 7, 10 reps, 10 pull-ups every single time you go through that door. By the end of the day, you're doing hundreds of chin-ups. And you don't start with this. You don't start doing that. You don't start with high amounts. You could do this with push-ups as well. Do one push-up every time you go in the door, or three push-ups, whatever it is. The main characteristic being, number one, it has to be a perfect repetition, like really good technique, and it's nowhere near failure. So if you're doing 5 reps, 7 reps, 10 reps, you should still be nowhere near failure. If you take a rock climber, someone who's been rock climbing professionally, they could probably be doing like 15 reps every time they walk in that door because they can do pull-ups for days. But
could do them on their fingers, you know?
Exactly. They do it with their tiny little fingertips. So that's what I would recommend. I'd be doing chin-ups every time you go through that doorway. And even if it's like if someone is napping for 30 minutes, an hour, even 2 hours, cool. Then you have those couple hours where you're not doing it. That's fine. But the rest of the day when you go through that door, that's what you do. And maybe during the naps, maybe that's when you do push-ups. Okay. Maybe you grease the groove with push-ups. Like every time you go through your kitchen, cool, I'm going to do 5 push-ups.
Okay. And that way I have an antagonistic movement going.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I'm assuming, at least for myself, I'm probably going to accumulate fatigue over the course of the day. Is there at some point where I should just call it? Like if I can't get a clean single rep?
If you are anywhere near failure or your technique is breaking down, you stop immediately. And it's a learning process. You have to learn and you're going to feel and learn from your body. But eventually when you get really good at grease the groove, you'll never get to that point.
Yeah.
You don't allow that to happen. But if you're going through that room over and over and over and over and over again, and like you just can't do it, yeah, you call it. If you're anywhere near failure or if the rep isn't clean, you stop it. Or you figure out a way to modify it so it's not like that anymore. So for example, if you could have a band and do an assisted chin-up, cool, then that's fine. Or if someone's doing push-ups and they can't do a full push-up anymore or at all, they elevate their hands. They elevate their hands onto their kitchen table or onto the wall, and they do it that way. You modify it in the same way you modify the number of reps to make sure you're not going to failure. You can also modify the type of movement you're doing to make sure you're still not going anywhere near failure.
Yeah. Personally, I find it much easier to do chin-ups than pull-ups.
Do whichever one you want or do both. Either one is totally fine.
Yeah. I was even just thinking I could start with pull-ups and then if that's a no-go, I could switch to chin-ups.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be totally fine.
Yeah. Cool. And
I'm not ignoring you, by the way. I'm scanning my blood sugar.
Oh.
I had a protein shake right before this, and I wanted to see how that affected my blood sugar.
How are you doing?
Good. It's doing good. I had trying to see. It's funny. It didn't affect it that much. So where we started this at 9:30, it means I had it right around like 8. Yeah, probably around like, yeah, it stayed relatively stable, which is very interesting. There also is, and this is worth noting, I just got a finger pricker as well. I'm going to pick that up today because it's downstairs in the mailroom. A lot of the people who have diabetes and have CGMs, continuous glucose monitors, there's a pretty significant margin of error in them because they're not actually measuring your blood. They're measuring the interstitial fluid. So it's getting a gauge of your blood sugar, but there mm-hmm. is a substantial margin of error. Whereas the blood prick that you've seen diabetics mm-hmm. do, that's legit. Like that's, you're actually testing your blood. So I'm going to get that and to calibrate my CGM just to make sure I'm getting very accurate readings. I did expect to see a little bit more, but there's a margin of error that could be taking place. There's a lot that could be happening. It's also only been 25 minutes. So maybe it's just hasn't given enough time yet.
Yeah. So it sounds sort of similar to the difference between the chest strap and then the watch fitness tracker in terms
yes,
of getting
exactly.
a good reading on your pulse. So are you also tracking your sleep with a tracker of some kind?
I have my Garmin, but just like you and I spoke about in terms yeah. of like, I don't really track HRV. I just know how much sleep I get. Like, yeah. and I know like, usually I can tell based on how I wake up. Did I have a good night of sleep or not? Like if I wake right. up feeling good and I had at least like 7.5 to 8 hours, I had a good night of sleep. If I wake up feeling like shit, usually didn't have the best sleep.
Yeah. I was just curious if, you know, you're talking about that cortisol spike, the dawn, what was it called? The dawn?
Dawn phenomenon.
The dawn phenomenon. yeah. So I was just curious, you know, if that's kicking in the middle of the night at some point, how that might relate to REM sleep
and
potentially bad dreams. I don't know. I'm just curious. I'm a nerd.
Dude, that's a great idea. Your stress starts going up. Start getting some bad dreams associated with that stress. That's a great point. I hadn't even thought of that. That could definitely potentially play a role.
Man, so cool. Do you have any other questions, thoughts?
No, man, that was good. I have jujitsu in a little bit, so I'm going to head out. But is there anything you want to end on?
I'm good.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have any questions you want us to answer, please shoot Tony a DM on Instagram. There have been a few messages, but not that many. So if you want to shoot Tony a DM, let him know. Even if you just want to say like, hey, I've enjoyed the podcast, or you guys can do this better, that better, whatever, please let us know. If you have not left a review for the podcast on iTunes or Spotify, please do. They really do help a lot. Oh, I need to say this. I remember in a recent episode, you and I spoke about how someone had left like a 3-star review. And in the comment, she wrote, I agree with 99% of the things you have to say, but then you said this one thing I disagreed with.
Yeah.
Dude, she went back and edited it.
Really?
And she went back and edited it and she gave it a 5-star and she added on to her thing. She was like, I listen to your podcast. You're 100% right. Just because we disagreed on that one thing doesn't mean that like I disagree on most or any of that. And so to that person, huge thank you for that. It means the world to me. And to that person for continuing to listen even after that means the world to me. So huge thank you. But the reviews actually, they help a tremendous amount in terms of getting new people to think about listening to the podcast. So thank you. It means a lot to me. I appreciate it. And have a wonderful day. And I'll talk to you soon.